Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Well, welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Tuesday, open forum day. So happy to have you here with us. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And if you've been hanging, don't worry, we're going to get to you. If you've been on the line for a little bit, we've got Jim Blackburn here with us. Jim is among the speakers you can book at your parish or event at CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. He formerly supervised the Q&A department here at Catholic Answers. He's a renowned author and speaker. His books include 101 Quick Questions with Catholic Answers, Marriage, Divorce, and Annulment, as well as a bunch of 20 Answers books in the series, the 20 Answers series. He's got one on Scripture and Tradition, one on the papacy, one on homosexuality, one on divorce and remarriage. Jim Blackburn, welcome. What happened to Jim Blackburn? I don't hear his voice. Sorry. You weren't there for a minute now. You're back. I said,
okay.
Hi, Jim Blackburn.
Hello, Cy. Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you. Sorry to have dropped you out there for a second. Now, I listed four 20 Answers books ending with divorce and remarriage. Have you done any new ones in the meantime?
I'm working on another one right now for publication this fall on the early church. And it's going to be there's so many Protestants, so many non-Catholic Christians who have no idea of what happened from the time say Jesus ascended into heaven, and we have, you know, some history in the Acts of the Apostles, but what really happened after that, and when was did the Catholic Church come about, and all of this, and I think it's really important to get that information out there. There are a lot of resources, early Christian writers, and historians who tell us what happened during that time period of the early church, and we really. When we study that, we read it, we come to the understanding that the church that Christ founded is the Catholic Church, and it's the same Catholic Church that still exists today.
Okay, so say I say to you, Jim Blackburn, as I sometimes hear people say, I just want Christianity the way Jesus taught it. I don't mm-hmm. want this hierarchical and sacramental church. I just want the church like it was right in the beginning. What would you say to him?
I would say that that's exactly how the church was from the beginning, because Christ did found a visible hierarchy of his church. The apostles were people who were set apart from his other disciples to be a hierarchy, and they went on to appoint others to take their place and to build the church up. They also, every one of the sacraments we can see being instituted by Christ in the New Testament, marriage being elevated to the dignity of a sacrament, but every one of them are there. So the church from the beginning was both hierarchical and sacramental, and these are actually some things I'm going into in my new 20 Answers book.
Are you going to name names? Will Clement be in there, and Ignatius and Polycarp and those guys?
The Apostolic Fathers are in there quite a bit, as well as the Fathers who followed in their footsteps. So just really chock full of quotes from these early Christians who show us, who demonstrate without a doubt this church was Catholic.
888-318-7884, the number here if you'd like to talk with Jim, 888-318-7884. Any question about the Catholic faith is welcome. When do you expect that? Because I'm looking for, I'm going to read that one. I'm not going to skim it. I'm going to read that early church one, Jim.
Great.
I'm not saying I skimmed your other ones. I'm not saying that out loud, but I am saying I'm going to read this one.
Well, ask Todd, but there are a few. There's a group of them that are going to be coming out sometime in the fall. I don't know when the actual publication date is. I know that I need to have my manuscript in sometime in the next couple of weeks to Todd. So it is something that's coming along pretty quickly, pretty soon.
Looking forward to it. As long as I can get it before Christmas, man.
Okay. Fall comes before Christmas.
Jim Blackburn, you know so much. You know so many things. Let's test your knowledge. Let's go to Caroline in Erie, Pennsylvania. How's that?
Sounds good.
All right. Let's see. Caroline, are you there? You got a question for Jim Blackburn?
Yes. Good evening and God bless.
Thank you. You too.
Good evening. I have a question that I never really thought about until the death of my mother earlier this year.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I never really, you know, I always remember learning about judgment after death and, you know, heaven, hell, those kind of things. But as I've been listening to the radio the past few months and maybe even before my mom's passing, hearing about the particular judgment, and I didn't realize that it was something that happens, from what I understand, in, like, upon the moment of death. And I'm wondering how a person, like in my mother's case, who became ill and was had her anointed, and she was kind of in and out for the week, and I don't even know if she realized she was dying. We never talked about it. And also had a brother killed in a car accident many years ago. And I'm just wondering how a person could be prepared. I know it's a mystery, of course, that can't be explained in one way, but how would someone be prepared to face Christ after those kind of deaths? Where, like I said, especially in because, you know, then you think, and I know my mother was a wonderful woman, and my brother, he was only 26, but I just think that it was sort of shocking to me to think about that.
Yeah, and Caroline, keep in mind, while we can't know for certainty what their particular judgments were, we know that God is just. And if you know your mother to have been a good person, was she a Catholic, Caroline?
She was actually a convert from her early age.
So she was a Catholic. Was she able to be administered last rites in their final days of life?
She was able to be anointed and to receive the viaticum. So
that's,
I was so
absolutely
blessed about that.
Beautiful. Yes. Well, those to be able to receive the sacraments before death are really a good reassurance that you can know that you can trust that she probably did die what we say would be a happy death. But this is what we need to do. We need to die in a state of grace, free from the guilt of mortal sin. Confession provides that for us. And when we receive viaticum, you know, that's the Eucharist, a term meaning for the journey. These give us grace in our souls and prepare us then for that supernatural life in heaven. But the primary thing, the most important thing, is that when we die in a state of grace, which means that the guilt of our mortal sins has been forgiven. That's what the sacrament of confession is for. So we want to go to confession at least as often as we commit a mortal sin, and the church wants us to confess our sins at least once a year. Secondly, mortal sins at least. Secondly, there are things we can do for the other consequences of our sin. You know, guilt, as the catechism teaches, guilt is the eternal consequence of when we commit a mortal sin. The guilt is something that prevents us from eternal life. When that guilt is forgiven, we can know that we're going to go to heaven, that sin's not going to keep us out of heaven. But there are other consequences that the church calls temporal consequences, that when our guilt has been forgiven, those temporal consequences remain. That's why we're given a penance at confession. It helps with the attachment to sin. It helps with making up for our sins in some small way. And then we also know God is extremely merciful. And if we die in his friendship, that is, without the guilt of mortal sin, even if there are still some consequences, some temporal consequences remaining, God even allows us to clean those up after death, and that would be what we call purgatory. One additional help is the church offers indulgences, and a partial indulgence forgives part of the temporal punishment due to sin, and a plenary indulgence forgives all of the consequences, the temporal consequences of that remain even after mortal sin has been forgiven. So these are all ways that we can assure that when we die, we're going to get to heaven as quickly as possible. So I hope that helps. Pray for your mother, because we can't know for certain what state she's in. She might need your prayers. So and our prayers will never be for naught. They're never going to go to waste. So pray for her. Pray for the repose of her soul. Have masses celebrated or offered for her and for your brother. And these are things that we can still do while we're alive to help them on their journey as well.
Thank you so much. It was very comforting, and I have been definitely praying for my mother. And I know that you can assign. I found out indulgence, if you earn one, that you can assign it to. Assign it to a deceased person. So it's next in line. Whoever's next right. in line.
Thank you for saying that, Caroline. That's an underappreciated fact or gift of our faith, that we can, in fact, pray for and even seek indulgences for those who have passed on.
That's right.
Next up, anonymous caller, anonymous location, but a friend to us. Anonymous, your question for Jim Blackburn.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if ever, in other words, when is it or if it ever is appropriate, barring like a priest having a heart attack on the altar or passing out, would it be okay for the priest to sit through on the altar, sit through the communion, and have the extraordinary ministers distribute communion?
Okay. Yes. After the consecration, if the priest if there are physical reasons why he needs to sit down, then absolutely that would be appropriate for him to have the extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion administer the communion. Ordinarily the priest is the ordinary minister of Holy Communion, and so ordinarily he's going to be participating in that distribution or being the only one administering the sacrament. But if he's physically got health problems or problems standing for a long period of time, whatever the case, if he's got an issue like that and he needs to sit down, then that's perfectly acceptable for him to do that.
Okay. I didn't feel that was the reason, but I just was curious if it was liturgically correct for someone to sit or a priest to sit during communion.
Yeah. Well, ordinarily, unless he's got a good reason, he should be administering the sacrament. But if he's got a good reason, then he can certainly sit down. Do you know what his reason would have been if you'd ask him, or did you ask him? Do you know what his reason was?
I did not ask him. No. Maybe the only thing I can think of was that. Maybe it was a little warm in the church.
Okay.
well, that can happen. I mean, a person can become overcome with the heat or be struggling with the heat.
Especially, he's standing a good part of the celebration of Mass, and it could be oftentimes, of course, the sanctuary is elevated, and it could be even warmer where he was. And look at the way he's dressed, with his priestly garments. The priest could have been feeling faint. It could have been the heat could have been getting to him, and that could have been an appropriate reason for him in that case to sit down. And I would say, if this was an isolated incident, I wouldn't be concerned about it. Now, if he just doesn't want to distribute communion, if he always just goes and sits down and it doesn't seem to be a good reason for it, you might ask him about it or to even talk to the bishop about it. But barring that, I would assume that he has a good reason to sit down if that's what he's doing.
Anonymous, thank you so much for that call. All those books we talked about that Jim wrote, all those 20 Answers books we were talking about at the beginning, they're on sale. Right now we have that back to school thing going on, and 20 Answers, his 20 Answers books are part of the 20 Answers student pack, a very special student bundle of 20 Answers booklets that give your student heading off to school answers to questions they are most likely to face as they head back to school. Visit the special back to school category at shop.catholic.com for more information. We've got dozens of great resources on sale to help shore up the faith of your student returning to school. Visit shop.catholic.com and look for the Back to School special.
Often, when confronted with the apostles' claim that Jesus rose from the dead, people ask if they made it up. And it's a reasonable question. So, did they? I don't think so, and here are a few reasons why. First, the early Christians had nothing to gain and everything to lose in lying about Jesus' resurrection, which makes their testimony credible. As Paul argues in 1 Corinthians 15, the only outcome for him lying is persecution and death. How does that serve as motivation for a lie? Second, the gospel writers include women as the first witnesses. This is a big no-no if you're trying to fabricate a story in first century Judaism. According to the first century Jewish historian Josephus, the testimony of women wasn't considered reliable at the time. So, there's one thing we can be certain of. The apostles weren't lying about Jesus' resurrection. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
why
a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are
committed. As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Special welcome today to all our friends in Britain and Ireland. If you have a call from Britain or Ireland, just dial 011-888-318-7884. And if you want to see what's going on at the World Meeting of Families in Dublin, live coverage all this week on EWTN TV and radio. Don't the British people have a different word for zero than we have, though, Jim? Do you know? I thought maybe not, but I don't know if that's what they – maybe – or maybe I'm thinking of the letter Z where they say Z, I think, for the letter Z. I'm not good with my British stuff.
Sorry, I can't help you there.
You can't help me?
No.
Oh, man. I was counting on you. I thought you knew so much. You do know a lot.
Not about – Brit speak.
Not about, no. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Jim Blackburn's our guest. We're having fun. And we move now to Jeremy in Fort Worth, Texas, watching on Facebook. Jeremy, thanks for your call and for watching on Facebook. Your question for Jim Blackburn.
Sure. Thank you very much for taking my call. I really appreciate it. One of the things that I have concern about is, for example, at Mass on Sunday, all the talk prior to the Mass was, what are we going to hear from the pulpit about this latest abuse and scandal and cover-up? And that's all literally anybody was talking about, and we heard nothing. And I know so many people that had that similar experience on Sunday, and those that would defend it were saying, well, we just have to wait, and the Pope is going to write a letter, and we'll hear it eventually. And it's starting, and so then that particular day, I heard nothing. And so then I go home and I'm thinking to myself, well, be part of the change, you know, be part of things differently. So I started looking up what it would take to become a deacon in my church. And I saw that I was disqualified because I've had a vasectomy, you know, prior to returning to the Catholic faith. And it's something that I regret and I wish I never would have had it done. And so I was sitting there and it just dawned on me that what is it you can say to somebody who logically wants to stay in the Catholic Church, but who's fed up with the lack of taking this particular problem seriously, in the sense that I now find myself talking to other Catholics in an apologetic fashion. And the only defense is you almost have to end up normalizing the behavior by saying, well, you know, it's like this everywhere, and it's worse here, and it's only 0.4% of the priest population. And next thing you know, it's like, but what I'm seeing in my world, among all the Catholics in my world, everybody's had enough. And it's like, and you start hearing the particulars of this, you start hearing the particulars of the abuse, and it is, I mean, I'm a psychotherapist. I mean, I have a clinical practice, and it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. you know? And I guess my question is, it's like, I'm eliminated from being in the deaconate because I've had a vasectomy prior to returning to the church. And I'm sitting here going, you know, starting to not make sense. And it's not making sense to a logical, understanding, and reasonable person, like my, which is what I consider myself to be.
Okay. So I think, Jeremy, you know, primarily your concern is you know, where is the response, say, from our bishops? Where's the response from the Vatican on this? And, yeah, what came to light recently in Pennsylvania is almost like what happened, oh gosh, 15 years ago all over again. And it's tragic. It's a tragic situation when these things come to light. But two things. First of all, I'll tell you, I'm in the Diocese of Orange. I live in Orange County, California, and the Diocese of Orange, our Bishop Kevin Vann, he wrote a very very nice, encouraging, thoughtful letter. It was read in all of the parishes this past weekend at the Saturday evening vigil masses and the Sunday masses. It's printed in bulletins. It's on parish websites and the diocesan website. So I can say, I can speak for my bishop locally. He is speaking out on this. He is saying something. You're not experiencing that maybe in your area right now, Jeremy, but I believe you're in Fort Worth, Texas. So you probably know who Bishop Kevin Vann is because he came to the Diocese of Orange from Fort Worth. Secondly, you know, what do we say? Yeah, we find ourselves defending the faith, even among Catholics who are scandalized by, you know, what has come to light in Pennsylvania and these scandals that come to light from time to time. What do we say? Well, I did write an article about this several years ago. You can find it at Catholic.com. It's titled Scandal, There is Nothing New Under the Sun. Go to Catholic.com and pull that up because I explain in that even though we see this happening right here in our day and in our time, this is something that has always been an issue in the church. It was an issue in the very first century. It was an issue in the church even when Jesus founded his church. You know, one of the apostles he appointed was Judas, and Judas would betray him. And it would be said of Judas that it would have been better had he never been born. You know, talk about scandal. You know, we have this from the first century. St. Peter, our first pope, had to be rebuked by Paul. I talk about this in this article. So even our popes are not above a scandal. We have to realize we're all sinners. This is a church of you know, four sinners. I mean, it's if you took all of the sinners out of the church and only had saints in the church, we really wouldn't have a church anymore. So we need to realize that even our hierarchy, even our bishops, and sometimes even our popes down through the history of the church have sinned in a way that becomes public and it causes scandal. But we don't want to walk away from Christ and his church because there are some bad eggs in the hierarchy. If we did that, then in the very first century, we would have walked away from the church that Christ founded because of Judas. And we would not have wanted to have done that and separated ourselves from this church that Christ founded. And just as that have been true then, it's true today. We don't want to walk away from the church that Christ founded just because there have been some horrific things done by some of the hierarchy. What we need to do is do what we can as the laity to help get rid of this problem. I think it's very clear, it's largely a problem of homosexuality in the priesthood. And in response to the scandal 15 years ago, the church did determine, you know, that if someone suffers from homosexuality and has acted out on it, you know, if it's deep rooted, then they're just, we're not going to consider them for the priesthood. You know, maybe today it should be, if a person suffers from homosexuality at all, whether he's acted out on it or not, maybe it could be that he's just not fit for the priesthood. It's not, not, not to, uh, to, to attack his dignity, because he may be fighting that temptation and winning. But nonetheless, the temptations that can result in the priesthood can, especially when a priest is around other young men, it can, you know, put a person in a situation of potential sinning, and so the priesthood just might not be the right place for that person to be. So I think, Jeremy, in final answer to your question, I hope that your local bishop will address this. I hope the U.S. bishops will get together, do some house cleaning, and respond to the faithful in such a way that the faithful will remain faithful.
Thanks, Jeremy. Jim Blackburn, our guest this hour. It's Open Forum. If you have any question at all about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call. 888-318-7884, the number 888-31-TRUTH. Be right back with more of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture's moral center continues to fly apart, and with every form of deviance publicly aired and celebrated, we have no choice but to equip our kids to understand about such issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. Silence can no longer be an option. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Looking for the best and solid Catholic resources that can answer your questions on all things Catholic? Looking for books, audio, and DVDs by the top Catholic thinkers and speakers on the planet today? Stop in today and visit the shop at Catholic.com. All of our resources are time-tested, apologist-vetted, and trustworthy and faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church. There's no better source for solid Catholic resources anywhere on the Internet. When you're shopping for good Catholic books, CD, DVDs, and more, turn to someone you can trust. Visit the shop at Catholic.com today. That's shop.catholic.com.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. Do you have questions about the Catholic faith? Get the answers on Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum. Jim Blackburn, our guest. 888-318-7884, our number. And we go now to Alan in Springfield, Missouri, listening on KQOH. Alan, your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Alan.
Well, my main question is, and I usually can answer pretty good, but a lot of times some non-Catholics that are Christian, but they like to try and tell me about how I know that the Catholic Church was the first Christian church that was started by Jesus.
Okay, Alan, you're just coming in and out. So, how do we know? I'm just going to rephrase it for Jim and let him answer it, and we'll see how we can come back to you. But we'll see if the phone line clears up a little bit. So, how do we know that the Catholic Church is really, this is a perfect question for you, Jim Blackburn, is really the church that Jesus founded, the original?
It kind of leads into a shameless plug for my book that's going to be coming out this fall on the early church, because this is what I really bring out quite a bit, is and show that continuation from Christ and the apostles to the apostolic fathers, to the early church fathers, and show this succession that happens in the early church, and not just the succession of the hierarchy, but the continuation of the constant doctrine of the church, the faith that was the deposit of faith that as it was handed on to the apostles and their successors. And so I wish I could offer that book to you right now, but I can't, until this fall. Two of the booklets that I've written for 20 Answers, though, are very closely related to this. One is on the papacy, and the other one is on scripture and tradition. So I encourage you to pick up copies of those. It's about the hierarchy of the church and the founding of it and the continuation of it, as well as, you know, what is it that we see as authority. But one thing, Alan, that I like to bring up is oftentimes a Protestant or a non-Catholic Christian will say, well, I'm not Catholic, I'm just Christian. You know, we know from Scripture that, you know, in Acts chapter 11, that Paul and Barnabas were teaching in Antioch, and that it was there that the disciples were first called Christians. So I'm a Christian. I'm not a Catholic. I'm a Christian. And this is actually something that I am going into in my new book, explaining that, you know, it was what happened, what people don't really realize is that at that church of Antioch, that church was historically, we know it was founded by Peter. Yes, Paul taught there, but Peter appointed a guy named Evodius to be the first bishop following Peter of that church of Antioch. And it was under Evodius, that Bishop Evodius, that when Paul was there teaching and the disciples were first called Christians. Well, if we look into a little bit more history, we see that after Evodius was the bishop of Antioch, we have St. Ignatius of Antioch following in his footsteps as the next bishop of Antioch. And it was under St. Ignatius of Antioch that those same Christians were called Catholic. In fact, the earliest use of the word Catholic to refer to the early church we find in the writings of St. Ignatius, but he uses it in such a way that it's obviously been around for a while, and in fact, very likely came from the time of the apostles themselves. But if you want to be associated with those Christians of the first century that we read about in Acts chapter 11, then you don't only want to be called Christian, but you want to recognize that their church, and so your church, is the Catholic Church. So this is a chapter right out of my new book that's coming out this fall, and I'd encourage you to take a look at that as well when it's available, Alan. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
888-31 Truth. The number, we go now to Teresa in Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. Teresa, your question for Jim Blackburn.
Okay, my name is Michael.
Oh.
And I'm calling from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, okay. Hi, well, that's Michael, we're happy to have you. I think we got our Oregon buttons crossed.
I've been listening to you for a long time, and one of the issues that I think we Catholics need to know about the priest's sexual scandal is that somebody said yesterday that the gates of hell, that the church is not a true church. If he's properly catechized, he would realize that Christ did say the gates of hell shall not prevail against it, against the church. He didn't say the gates of hell will not come knocking, because the gates of hell knocked even when Christ was alive. Okay. Right from the temptation after
sure.
40 days fast to when Judas sold him for 30 pieces of silver. The gates of hell knocked, but Christ never succumbed to it, and the church did not. And the church has suffered this tribulation for 2,000 years. This too
yes.
will pass and will come out stronger.
Fair enough, Michael. Do you have a question for Jim Blackburn?
Pardon? No, I just wanted to make that as a comment because it saddened me that so many of us call ourselves Catholics, but we are like one leg in the church.
Yes, I think you're exactly right, Michael. That is the case for many of us. And even those of us who get both legs in, sometimes we pull a leg out. It's like a little bit of hokey pokey, and we just need to stop doing that. Thank you, Michael. I'm going to keep moving because I want to get to as many questions as I can. Casey in Sacramento, you are up next. Your question for Jim Blackburn. Casey?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Casey.
My question is, I've been divorced for past 2 years by the state, and my annulment through the church is actually final today.
Okay.
Throughout the past year, though, I've been engaged, and I'm going to remarry, and I've been having trouble with remaining abstinent throughout that process. We live together, and financially, that's the only way we can survive. So we're living together under one roof, and we've gone to confession many times and always end up failing at the end, to fall into temptation. So I'm looking for advice on breaking that mortal sin and leaving it behind us until we do get married, and also any sort of repentance, anything we can do together as a couple to repent of this sin, to hopefully have a blessed marriage in the future and move forward.
Okay. Well, Casey, first, let me recommend that you talk to a spiritual director about the situation that you're in, because a spiritual director can spend more time talking about all the different aspects of your relationship and make some probably some good recommendations to help you with that. The first thing that comes to my mind is, not only do we not want to sin, but we don't want to put ourselves in the near occasion of sin. We don't want to put ourselves in a tempting situation. In fact, if we knowingly and willingly do that, that can often be sinful itself. You mentioned that you're living together and that you need to, well, I guess financially, I would look at until you're married, do what you can to not live together. And I know that might be a struggle, but I can tell you nothing is worth leading yourself into sin for. If it's a financial struggle, the difficulties there are far, far less significant in the long run than falling back into sin. And you know, you said that you've been to confession, and yet you keep falling back into the sin. Knowing that, I would encourage you, very strongly encourage you, to eliminate that situation. I think you and your future wife would be very happy down the road if you do that now. You will look back and realize that was the right thing to do, and feel very blessed that you did that, especially if it works. It keeps you from falling back in to sin. We also, when we're in a situation like this, we have to be cognizant of, what do others think about this? I assume your friends, your family knows that you had attempted marriage before. That's been annulled. Declaration of nullity has been granted to you on that. So you're not married to anyone right now, and you're planning to marry this woman, but you're living together now. What are they thinking about you? Are they looking at you and thinking, wow, Casey, it's all right for Casey, especially say your younger relatives? Are they looking at you and saying, well, Casey apparently thinks this is okay, so I'm going to move in with my girlfriend? This is called scandal. So not only do we want to avoid sin ourselves and avoid the near occasion of sin, but we want to avoid leading others into sin. So those are the big things I would encourage you to think about. Talk to a spiritual director about it, and see if you can make those changes that are necessary to keep from falling into sin, so that when you do finally get married in the church, and and can be assured that this is a valid marriage this time around, it will be that much more beautiful, and the wait will have been worth it. And that's it'll be a blessing to you and to your future wife.
Okay, Casey.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. That all makes sense. Do you have any advice as far as finding the right spiritual guider and how do I go about finding somebody who can help me with that?
I would, Casey, talk to your local parish. Just call the parish office or stop into the parish office and ask for a recommendation. It could be a priest. It could be a religious. It could be a layperson who has a degree in pastoral ministry. So there could be a number of people, but I'd start there and see what you can find. Just make sure that the spiritual director is authentically Catholic and will not, give you bad advice. I've heard some stories about that. So just ask for a very Orthodox Catholic spiritual director, and I think that'll help. And if I could make one more recommendation to you, Casey, in my booklet, 20 Answers, Divorce and Remarriage, I spend the first several chapters explaining what authentic marriage is and what Jesus did in elevating it to the dignity of a sacrament, and how we should all approach marriage and see ourselves as Christ-like to our spouses and help each other to get to heaven, just as Christ helps his church to get to heaven, these kinds of things. And I do all this so that I can point out the ugliness of divorce and the necessity for annulment and what needs to take place before remarriage. But I'd encourage you to take a look at that booklet. If you don't have it, maybe Cy, we could have the call screener send them a copy of that, because I really think especially the first few chapters, Casey, would if you and your fiancé sit down and read it together, I think it can help you see the beauty of what you're entering into down the road and why doing what you're doing now can reduce the dignity of it.
Casey, stay on the line, and we'll put you through to Marie. Will come on and get your digits to send you that book if you would like it. Hey, you can become a parish partner and distribute Catholic Answers Live materials like bumper stickers, window clings, bulletin inserts, info cards, other materials at your parish. This helps raise awareness about Catholic Answers Live, and it invites a lot of people to join this program. And you have to know that maybe your parish is in one of those areas where Catholic Answers Live used to be on the air but isn't anymore. Well, you can let people know that we're still here. I got a tweet the other day. Somebody thought we weren't on the air anymore. And I was like, yeah, we're on the air on 360 stations, but maybe just not your station. You just email us at calpartners@catholic.com, calpartners@catholic.com. Become a parish partner and help get the word out that Catholic Answers is here and trying to help. We'll be right back after this.
This is Dr. Scott Hahn, and stay tuned for more Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Here's one thing that I would recommend, what I call gap time. So, for example, you're driving in the car. When you're at home, maybe doing dishes, what are you listening to on the plane? See, I use all those gap opportunities and fill those gaps with things that are going to strengthen and deepen my faith. So I listen to EWTN podcasts all the time because I also want to learn and grow and deepen in my faith.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jim Blackburn, our guest this hour, and we go straight away to Thomas in Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. Ooh, had a little problem with a call from Modern Day Radio a minute ago. Do I have Thomas in Portland? Is that correct? Hello? Oh, I don't know what's going on with our... It's nothing to do with Modern Day Radio. They're fine. One of the great Catholic radio stations, one of the oldest Catholic radio stations in America. But for some reason, the calls are that I'm getting from Oregon are not working out for me today. So I'm going to go to Joseph in California, watching on YouTube. Joseph, we're happy to have you. Your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hello, Jim. Okay,
hello.
So my priest, he asked me a question at church, and he wanted me to go like search for answers for the question. So my question is, he asked me, when he blesses food at lunchtime, and if you have like leftover food or whatever, and then we eat it for dinner, does he have to bless it again?
Hang on. Before you answer that,
so why,
Jim? So this mm-hmm. is homework that you got from your priest, and you're calling Jim Blackburn to do your homework for you. Am I correct in that, Joseph?
Well, this is one of the ways I find like answers to certain questions that I have. So,
oh no, we're happy to have you. We're happy to have you. I just wanted to make sure I understood. Prepare because this is going to be a fantastic answer. I know it is because of Jim Blackburn. Your priest is going to love this answer.
Well, Joseph, you know, what do we do when we bless something? A blessing is intended to set something aside for a good, and especially a good towards God, toward His church, towards our love of God, and all of this. Set something aside for a sacred purpose. And when we bless our food, you know, we're asking God to make this food a blessing to us, so that we then can do our work as Christians and such. But once something has been blessed, you know, it doesn't lose its blessing until it is with the church terminology would be on this, is if it's been converted to profane use. Now, profane doesn't mean it's not quite as ugly as it sounds. Profane just means if it's no longer going to be used for a sacred purpose, now it's being used for a profane or a secular purpose. Well, as long as that food is still intended, for us, and we intend that blessing of that food, it's not going to lose its blessing. So it wouldn't be necessary to bless it again. But you know what? I pray for blessing every time I eat, even if I'm eating leftovers and I prayed for it before. It's not going to hurt. In fact, a second blessing maybe could be helpful. So, Joseph, I would say it's not necessary to bless the food again, but it's not going to do any harm to do that. Okay?
Joseph, you think that'll work?
Yeah.
Okay. I want this to work for your priest. I thought what Jim was going to say was, when you bless food, if you put it in the refrigerator, then the blessing keeps. But if you leave it out on the shelf, then the blessing will go bad. But that was not, I'm not a very good theologian.
I would say though, let's say, Cy, that, you know, you bless the food, or you have even Father over for dinner, and he does a blessing over the food. So you have a priestly blessing over your food. And then you're eating it and you have leftovers. The next day, you decide, I'm just going to feed this to the dog. It has then no longer been set aside for a sacred use. It's set aside for, you know, for our animal to eat. And therefore, I would say it would lose its blessing at that point. That's just an additional thought I had on it.
Okay, so I get that. That's right. So now it's no longer being set aside, and it kind of just, Jim Blackburn doesn't like dogs. That's what you're saying.
I do. I have a dog, and I like to feed her leftovers. So,
I got a question for you from Facebook, from Aaron on Facebook, he typed it in. He said, a family member is getting married in a Methodist church. They asked me to participate. Am I allowed to do so? Now, Jim, I don't know what the word participate means in this context. Mm-hmm. So you'll have to maybe fill that in.
Okay. It's a good question, one that comes up from time to time. And it's one I actually answer in my book on 101 Quick Questions on Marriage, Divorce, and Annulment. And it's going to depend. If this relative is not a Catholic, never has been, and the person he's marrying is not a Catholic, never has been, then their marriage in a Methodist church, the Catholic Church is going to recognize that as being a valid marriage, and there's no reason why you can't attend that wedding, either as on the side of the bride or the groom, or even participate, you know, as a groomsman or a best man. You could even do that. That would be okay. The problem that we run into sometimes is when you've got a Catholic who maybe is a fallen away Catholic, and he's going to get married in the Methodist Church or a non-Catholic church, and he doesn't get a dispensation from his bishop. That's a Catholic. Once you're Catholic, you're always a Catholic in the eyes of God and in the eyes of the church. And you then, when you're a Catholic, you're subject to the laws of the church. You know, Jesus said that first to Peter and later to all the apostles with Peter, that what you bind on earth is bound in heaven. What you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. The Catechism of the Catholic Church tells us that under that umbrella of binding and loosing comes the church's authority to impose certain laws on the faithful for the good of the faithful. Well, the church has done that when it comes to marriage law. And one of the laws the church has instituted is that Catholics must either get married according to the Catholic form of marriage, which is, would be in the Catholic Church ordinarily, or if he's going to get married another way, he needs to have a dispensation from his bishop. The bishop needs to formally approve that. Especially if he's marrying another Christian, or even if he's oftentimes marrying even a non-Christian. There are certain nuances here I'm not going to go into the specifics of, but the permissions are ordinarily required. So to wrap this up, I would say, Aaron, if they're not Catholics and never have been, you can attend, you can participate, rejoice. The Catholic Church, God is recognizing this as a valid marriage as far as we can tell. If one or the other is a Catholic and has not gotten a dispensation because he's a fallen away Catholic, then I could not participate in that because the church isn't going to recognize that. God's not going to recognize that. And so therefore, who am I to recognize that? And my opinion would be not to support them in that, because they're going to be entering into a situation that looks like marriage and that they believe is marriage, but in actuality, it's not marriage. One additional resource I would give you on this, Aaron, is back when we used to have the Catholic Answers blog, I did a couple of blog posts titled "Should I Attend or Not?" And it was a two-piece blog post, and where I give my initial response and then I follow up on some questions that I got asked after I posted it. So go to Catholic.com and look for "Should I Attend the Wedding or Not?" It's titled something like that by me, Jim Blackburn, and I think those could shed some additional light on why, if this is not going to be a valid marriage, we wouldn't want to participate or attend even. All right. So I hope that helps, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron, for that question. Let's see if we – I think we have time for one, but maybe two. I don't know. But Benjamin in Rhode Island listening on the Catholic Answers app, could you make your question or phrase it as quickly as you can to give Jim a chance to answer?
Yes, no problem. So my question is so we see in John's gospel when Jesus is on the cross and he says to the repentant thief, "This day will be with me in paradise." But we know that Christ didn't ascend into heaven until a while later. So would you be able to explain kind of what he meant by that? And I ended up looking back at the Greek and it's like the word day is like the word day. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could kind of touch on that.
Let me ask you, Benjamin, where's the comma? When you went back and looked at the Greek, where is the comma place? That's a trick question because there are no commas in the Greek. And so we really don't know when Jesus said this. Did he say, "I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise"? Or did he say, "I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise"? This is just one possible nuance we can look at here and say, you know, what did Jesus mean when he was saying this? But let me leave you with a resource, another article I wrote many years ago, Dismissing the Dismas Case. Dismas was the good thief on the cross beside Jesus. And I go into the question you've asked and several others about Dismas and being in his promise of paradise. So I hope that will help you, Benjamin.
Benjamin, sorry we had to get you in real quick there at the end, but thank you for the call. Jim Blackburn, thank you for another fine hour of Open Forum.
Thank you so much for having me, Si. God bless you.
And people can find you at Jim Blackburn.com.
Jim Blackburn.com. org.
Oh, I almost had it. JimBlackburn.org. Go and take a look. Find Jim. Tomorrow, Dr. Stacy Trisenkos will be here. We're going to talk about faith and science. As a matter of fact, we're going to talk specifically about evolution. Looking forward to that conversation with chemist and theologian Stacy Trisenkos. See you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.